Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
It's our tradition to go around and introduce ourselves. I always like to ask people to take a breath and listen to the name that you've just heard before you bounce in with your own. Is there anybody here for the first time or after a very long absence? All old-timers, okay. My name is Joe.
My name is Dennis.
I'm Jack.
I'm Mike.
I'm John.
I'm Tony.
I'm Pat.
I'm Ed.
My name is Mark.
David.
I'm Jerry.
My name is Jeff.
I'm Bob.
Harley.
Michael.
My name is Tom.
My name is Ivan.
My name is Joe.
Kevin.
Peter.
Larry.
Stephen.
Ted.
My name is Paul.
David.
My name is Alzac.
My name is Michael.
Jim.
Mark.
I'm Andreas.
Don.
My name is Cass.
I'm Eugene.
Yeah, that's Eugene right there. Eugene Cash is a founding teacher of the San Francisco Insight Meditation Community of San Francisco. He teaches at Spirit Rock Meditation Center and leads intensive meditation retreats internationally. His teaching is influenced by both Burmese and Thai streams of the Theravada tradition, as well as Zen and Tibetan Buddhist practice. He's also teacher of the Diamond Approach, a school of spiritual investigation and self-realization developed by A.H. Almas. And we're honored to have you back, Eugene. Thank you.
Great to be back with you. Please wave at me if my voice gets too quiet, because I tend to speak softly. And don't be shy. Yeah, wave a lot, big wave. And it's interesting you do the name go round at San Francisco Insight. We used to do that. I've been teaching there 26 years, something like that. And we used to do that in the old days. And even now, as we were going around, it was great to see the name and then also to say my name. But I also thought, like, oh, that's not who I am. I like Eugene, and I like the name. It's a good name, and it works, but it's also, it's not exactly the whole truth of who's here and what's here. And I think that's also accurate when I look around and hear Mark or Mike or whatever your name might be, that that's, a name, you probably got it a long time ago, not a recent name. And they gave it, at least they gave me the name. I remember looking around thinking, oh, who's Eugene, And they kept pointing at me. And then that name lands and becomes who we take ourselves to be. And part of the reason I'm starting like this is because I want to talk a little about knowing and not knowing, and the importance of not knowing everything, and the import of not even knowing who we are totally, because we know, I know Eugene, where Eugene lives and where his car got parked and things like that, but there's more to learn, and the not knowing is an important part of the meditative practice, and it's an important part of the investigative practice, which are very closely linked in meditation. In the Theravada, the seven factors of enlightenment, or the better said, the seven factors of awakening are characterized, first of all, by mindfulness, and then the next factor is investigation. And so it's something about, oh, we want to get here, and then we want to see what's actually here. And here I'll add a little more. You can even play with this. What's even contemplating what's actually here? That was good, what I just said. That was the best thing you got so far. Really. So, and look and see what's contemplating what's here. Because it starts to point us at consciousness itself, which is part of the water we swim in that we never pay attention to. We're always aware of the objects or the things or the experiences or what we know. We don't pay attention to what's knowing. Okay? So be aware, even now, if you're having thoughts or feelings about what I'm saying, which is all good, all fine, pay attention to what's having the thought, what's having the feeling, instead of just being identified with the thought and feeling, which we generally are, which, you know, works relatively well, but it's not the whole picture. And of course, none of this is on my talk, so let me see if I can get back to what I was going to talk a little bit about what's important about meditating. And let me just see, how many people meditate every day? Let me see. Here, a better way to say it, how many people don't meditate every day? Be honest. Yeah, good. That's good. I don't meditate every day either, but mostly I do. And so I thought I would talk a little about the import of meditation, and especially these days. I was at the glass store, and the woman, we just started having a conversation about glasses. I was looking to get these fixed, and she fixed them. But she started talking about, oh, you know, she's going crazy because of politics. And I'm like, really? And she said, yeah, I'm da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, all about the political situation, which in my not-Buddhist shorthand stinks, or sucks, generally, is what I would say. But she would say, yeah, it's just driving me crazy, and I talk about it all the time. And I said, oh, wow, I never talk about it, or rarely talk about it. And she said, really? I said, yeah, because I could talk about it forever if I start talking about it. And she kept saying how it was driving her crazy. And I said, that's not a good response to what's happening. That you get driven crazy, that's not skillful. And she doesn't know I'm a Buddhist teacher. I just say I teach publicly. I tell her I'm a teacher, but I didn't want to say I'm Buddhist. But I was saying, you know, going crazy is not helpful. I mean, it happens, and believe me, I've gone crazy plenty in my life, but it's not what's needed. And so one of the things that's skillful is learning how to sit and actually get here and be here and wake up right here in this experience. Because right in this moment, nobody's actually going crazy. Right? We're just sitting here in this, you know, lovely little center, and we're not doing anything, really. We're just hanging out. And I often think of meditation as a certain kind of hanging out or not doing, but just learning something about being, about the beingness of what it is to be a human being. Because I believe that's what's needed to respond to the craziness of the world and society and ourselves. And of course, just to give you a little context, I just came off a 10-day retreat on the East Coast at the sister center of Spirit Rock, which is the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. And it was great. I actually went to visit my daughter, who was in a play in New York, and got to see her in the play, which was great. And then I got to leave and go sit for 10 days, and so appreciated the 10 days of sitting, of doing nothing, just sitting, just being there, just seeing, what is this? What is this experience of sitting in your seat? What is it really? And what is it when we start to turn our attention, our awareness, to this experience that's alive, and I would say magically alive, you know, because it won't be here forever, I can assure you all of that. And see, what is this? What is this that the Buddha said can wake up, and that can wake up in any moment, and start to wake up and discover the depth or breadth of who and what we are, and what it is to be a human being? Because we're all in that category. We're human beings. And I don't know about all the other species. I have a lot of love for animals of all kinds, but I don't know if they have the same self-reflective awareness that we have. You know, they have a lot of awareness and a lot of consciousness. They have that. But I don't know if they can turn and know themselves, and know themselves more and more in the way that we as human beings have that capacity. And so one of the imports of meditation is just to get here in a real way, in a no bullshit way, like, oh, what's actually here, right? Body, heart, and mind. Like the whole thing, what is this? And what is it right now? And what's knowing what it is? So I'm coming back to what I started with about, right? There's, because you're aware of what's happening in your body right now. I have total faith in that. You're comfortable, or you're uncomfortable, or you're tired, or you're energized, and you know it. Or your heart, you're feeling good, or you're feeling down, or you're feeling neutral, or whatever you're feeling, right? You're aware of it. And your thoughts, I'm sure you're aware of whatever the hell you're thinking, right? Whether you like what I'm saying, don't like what I'm saying, or whether you're thinking about, oh, how soon will this be over? And, I'm going to get, it's beautiful out. Maybe I should have gone out. You can be aware of your mind. You don't have to change any of it, but you can be aware of all of it, and you don't have to be bound to any of it. That's the radical potential that Buddhism and meditation offers, that can be able to be aware of experience, have experience, even respond at times to experience, but we don't have to be bound to it. And so getting here that meditation offers us is brings a certain kind of presence that is invaluable, that is classically talked about as Buddha nature. It's like, oh, it's not just our sense of self. It's not just Eugene and Eugene's personality. There's more here than just Eugene and his psychology and his personality and whatever he's been through or gone through. Those are all here. We're not trying to get rid of anything, deny anything, pretend anything away. But we don't want to simply be bound to part of the reality of what's here. We want to keep looking very clearly to see what is consciousness, and what is presence, and what is self, and what is not self, or beyond self, or sometimes in Zen they talk about small self and big self. And the kind of preciousness of human life that is sitting here, that's breathing, that's only alive for a short time, right? Whatever it might be, it could be 1 year, it could be 50 years, it could be 70 years, it could be 100 years, it could be 120, and then it's just gone. The whole thing just arises and passes. And that's not to negate any of it, or deny any of it, or not even not to enjoy any of it, but also to see, oh, what else is here? What's never come and never goes? It's a nice Zen question. I like that. And I'm not a Zen teacher, but I love to steal from Zen because it's very real. And so the preciousness of human life brings a lot of love and heartfulness into practice. When we see how precious it all is, how simple it all is, how it just comes and goes. Every moment it's just coming and going. You know, it's just happening and it's gone. Right? I mean, we'll be out of here soon. It's just going to come and go. And I was thinking about what to talk about today, because part of the reason I wanted to talk about not knowing was I don't know what to talk about, right? I mean, I have ideas, but I'm like, oh, who's going to be there? And you know, and I have, you know, I've taught here before. I have some idea of some of you who are here, but still, even the people I know, I don't know. Right? Because whoever you were last time I was here, which is quite a while ago, and I have to apologize, last time I was supposed to be here, it fell off my calendar. I didn't even show up. How's that for not knowing? That's my apologies for that. And so I was thinking about what to talk about, and I thought a lot about love, because I just feel a lot of love for the human experience, and for us, for all of us, because we're all here together, all of us. People you don't like, we're still here together, all of us. I, as I get older, and I'm getting a little older, meaning a lot older, I keep feeling naive, because sometimes I feel like I can't believe there are still people who believe that it's us and them, right? Whatever the them might be, right? It could, if you're gay, you could be the them, right? If somebody's straight. Or if you're black, it could be you're the them. And, you know, there's the white people who think the black people are them. Or if it's, you know, if you're poor, you might be the them, you know, who the rich people think are them. You know, there's you know, I could go on and on, whether you're a woman or whatever your sexuality is or whatever your race is or whatever your religion of origin is or whatever your economic situation. There's always this division between human beings that I just is, in my humble opinion, ridiculous, because we're all here together and we all know a little bit, and we all don't know a lot. And we don't know a lot together. And we're all learning from one another, whatever your culture or race or religion or sexuality might be. And so, and I just feel naive when I think, oh, I can't believe people really believe this us and them shit. They really believe it. Like, seriously, and our politics, of course, is expressing it these days. And of course, all of this, some of this, is coming all out of my retreat, where I had one quote stuck in my mind very strongly, and it was from Suzuki Roshi. And he said, when I realized no moment could be repeated, I was awakened. When I realized no moment could be repeated, I was awakened. And that was resonant with me for my whole retreat. And I wasn't even that I was thinking about it, but it just was radiating a little in my system, because we all have no idea what's going to happen in the next moment, really. We all pretend we know, and sometimes we might be right. Like, I might keep talking in the next moment, that's true. But who knows, right? Because anything could actually happen. And being bound or attached or cathected or clinging to the knowing is suffering, is a form of suffering. That we could have our idea what's going to happen, and we also don't have to be bound to it. We can relax here and now and not know and see, because that makes life very alive, very real. And I sometimes these days I like to use the word magic, which I never used in Buddhism for a long time. Nobody much uses it in the Theravada tradition, but I started using it, and then it just fit for my experience that life is magical, that it's magical to be here right now, right? Or magical to be breathing, or magical to be thinking. Right, we so take it for granted, because I mean, I do have a little history. I had a bad bicycling accident, had a brain injury, bad brain injury, which is I don't recommend that. And, but it was very interesting because I lost everything for a while, and that was very something, because I didn't know, oh, you could lose everything in that way. I knew it in a meditative way, you could lose everything. But I didn't know it in just the normal everyday of life. Really, even when I, after 5 weeks in the hospital, I went home and I saw my Zafu and Zabutan, and I knew that people meditated on it, but I didn't know how to meditate. Mm-hmm. Right, this is after 25 years of meditation. I didn't have any, it wasn't there, because my brain wasn't working in its usual way. Mm-hmm. See, I'm getting some feedback sound for this. This was an important thing that happened. And I like music. and after a few days, I knew people sat on those, and I sat down on it, and I didn't know how to meditate. And I sat there for a little while, and I got up, and I didn't even have so much mind to be really self-reflective. I didn't think, oh, that's this or that. I just knew it was good. And I can't tell you, there was no why it was good. I didn't have enough mind to think why. But I knew it was good just to sit. And really, I didn't even think, oh, it's good to sit. It was so intuitive. It was so simple. And so the magic of reality, I've had a little bit of experience with in that kind of way. And the goodness of being here, and that every moment is part of practice, right? Every moment. That bicycle accident, pure practice, right? And everything that happened after that, all practice. Because what the hell else are you going to do with stuff like that, right? I could worry about it, or I could think about it forever, or I could grieve about it, and sometimes I do. Really, the grief came much later. In coming back, but it's all practice. Life is practice, and it doesn't mean, oh, we're supposed to sit all the time, but be aware and wake up and then live your life every moment. Here's, this is from St. John of the Cross, who was a secret Buddhist, who said, what is grace? I ask God, he says, what is grace? And God said, all that happens. And then God added, when I looked perplexed, could not lovers say that every moment in their beloved's arms was grace? Existence is my arms. Though I will understand how one can turn away from me until the heart has wisdom. What is grace? I asked God, and God said, all that happens, all that happens. And he added, when I looked perplexed, could not lovers say that every moment in their beloved's arms was grace? Existence is my arms. Though I well understand how one can turn away from me until the heart has wisdom. And so the wisdom of simply being alive in this moment, it means every moment. And it doesn't mean we like every moment, or we want every moment, or we're not going to respond to every moment. But it's all part of existence, right? For better or for worse, they say in certain marriage ceremonies, I believe, right? And we're married to existence, right? We're here. And so the beauty of the retreat of meditation, especially in that kind of intensive way that I was sitting, if you've never been on a Theravada retreat, you know, you sit, I don't know, anywhere from, you sit and do sitting and walking meditation, you know, at least 16 hours a day, more up to 20 hours a day, I've done it. And you get time to go to the bathroom and have some food, but basically that's all you're doing. And so the whole meditative capacity muscle gets tuned, right? And what it reveals is this grace, is the simplicity of being, of the beauty of being, what I call the magic of each moment, or the luminosity of each moment. And it's you can see it at a certain point, or I could when I was sitting. I don't see it every moment, but I feel it a little right now talking about it. There's a kind of radiance or sparkliness or aliveness or mystery or magic to even seeing you. Like, what is seeing all of you? What is talking? And it's not like, oh, I'm looking for it. It's already talking and happening. And so, and then just seeing each of you, totally different people, each of you, right? And, you know, different looks, different eyes, different colors, different texture, different radiance with each person here, right? And you can, at least in this seat, in this position, oh, you can see the aliveness of each person, even if they're bored or falling asleep, that's still alive, right? You know, and that, like I say, won't happen forever. And so that simplicity of being, the radiance of each moment, which sparkles. When we get here, we begin to discover more the depth or breadth of who and what we are, which is infinite, ultimately. And I saw a movie last night. I was looking around. I haven't been to a movie in quite a while. And I wanted to go, and And there were all these movies. I'd listed a bunch of movies. Blockers. Anybody hear of Blockers? Yeah, it's like, it's Blockers. It's made for like 21-year-olds for sure. But I didn't go to that. It was about three teenage girls who want to lose their virginity on prom night. That's what it's about. So I was interested in that. And it looked funny in a very, not my usual kind of humor, but so I thought it would be stepping outside of my box a little bit. And then there were others, Black Panther, which I want to see. And then there was, what else? There was a couple others. There was a documentary about Hedy Lamarr. People here would have heard of her. And then there was a documentary about Itzhak Perlman. And I like documentaries, so I thought I'd go see Itzhak Perlman. And I was a musician for many years, and so I like music. And I've heard him play, not in person, but he's the real thing. And I heard good things, that it would be uplifting, and I wanted a little uplift. And it was. It was very uplifting. And I recommend it to any of you, because he's been through a lot of shit, this guy. And he's so, his heartfulness and his joy and appreciation of life is very moving. Because he had polio at 4 years old and lost basically the use of both legs. He wears braces and has to use crutches and can't really walk far. Mostly as in a cart, and he became this phenomenal violinist. And I mean phenomenal. And what's nice is they have some films of him even young, and like at 12 and 13, I mean, he kills it, really. He's good. And he's so fun, and he laughs so much, and he has so much fun with people. He clearly loves people. And beautiful to watch what's possible for us, whatever our suffering may be. Because I assume you all know, if you're here in a Buddhist group, that the heart of Buddhist teaching is about suffering, the cause of suffering, the end of suffering, right? And so I assume you all know something about suffering, right? It's part of human reality. It's not something any of us don't know about. And yet, the potential to keep discovering what's not suffering is also right here and possible for all of us. And so I really appreciate the arts, and I've spent a lot of time, years in the arts. I did radical political street theater in New York in the 60s, right? And had a lot of fun, meaning happily didn't get into too much trouble in what we were doing, because we were with a lot of wild people in New York, and it was great. And that's why I started playing music, and then I performed for many years and played, had my own performing space here in San Francisco and many years ago. And I think of meditation often as an art. And it's an art what does it mean to get here? And what is it to stay really present and aware? Because if you're playing music, you are not thinking about what's happening tomorrow, right? Or if you're dancing, you're a dancer, right? You're not figuring out, what am I going to get at the grocery store today, right? You're right in the direct experience, which is what meditation is asking of us, to get here in this experience, this living, breathing, thinking, feeling experience right now, and become aware of it, because you can. It's possible to discover more of who and what we are, of the human potential, of our nature. And This is from Stephen Batchelor, who's a Buddhist teacher who I like, who's very into secular Buddhism in a funny way, or secular something, Dharma. But he I like what he has to say often. He talks about the artist's dilemma, the artist's dilemma, and the meditators are, in a deep sense, equivalent. Right? Both are repeatedly willing to confront an unknown and risk a response they cannot predict or control. Right? That as both artists and meditators are repeatedly willing to confront the unknown and to risk a response or a reality that they cannot predict or control. Both are disciplined in their skills and that allow them to remain focused on their task and to express their response in a way that will illuminate the dilemma they share with others. Right? So it means we can, with our discipline, and the discipline is sitting with some regularity. That's one of the things that will teach you how to sit. And of course, it's always good, at least in the Theravadin tradition, to get some instructions, and training is also helpful. He goes on to say, great art and great Dharma both give rise to something that that has never quite been imagined before. Great art and great Dharma both give rise to something that has never quite been imagined before. Artist and meditator alike ultimately aspire to an original act. That's beautiful. That's great. And what's the original act in meditation? It's the essence of who and what you are. It's totally brand new every moment. It's not a thing. It's not like this. It's magical. It has its own living mystery. Here, I'll add one more piece. This is last quote. This is from one of the teachers I've studied with who I like a lot, Sayadaw Utejaniya. And Utejaniya is a contemporary Burmese teacher and very popular these days. And here's a quote about a student talking to him. And the student said, a teacher from the Chinese Chan tradition talks about relaxing into nature as one's true nature. What is your understanding of seeing into self nature? And so Utejaniya, here's the way he says it. He says, the way I understand it is that we have made something that actually is nature into a self. We have made something that really is nature into a self. If we understand that we are making nature into a self, that we are creating a concept, the concept, of course, here being Eugene, right? That we are creating a concept, then what you said would make sense. Also, if we understand nature, we understand ourselves. Right? And so it's like any nature, right? It's one of the reasons, you know, the Buddha almost always lived and taught in nature. And so it's always a great thing to do. Go ahead, go. Why do we like being in nature so much? Which maybe some people don't, but most people like to be out, you know, somewhere. And I live next to Golden Gate Park. I love to be in the park. And it's like nature is right there just doing its thing without doing anything. It's just being itself. And we are nature, right? Everybody know that? Here, this is the second good thing I've said. We are nature. That's it, you know? And so start to get closer to your natureness. So I'm going to stop here. I like to always leave some time for comments, questions, you know, agreement, disagreement. I like, you know, anything that might have been interesting that I said or you want to talk about, or please.
I'm interested in your recovery from your bike accident and wonder if you could enlarge on it, particularly the details, like seeing the cushion.
Right.
And knowing that people meditated, but not knowing that you meditated.
Well, I knew I did have meditated, but I lost a lot of what's called executive functioning and a lot of self-reflective memory. So I knew I'd meditated, but I didn't know how to meditate. And recovery was slow and took quite a while. And here's the paradox, or one of the paradoxes. The doctors, who were very kind and did great with my body, which was all broken from the accident, I went once or twice to a recovery group that they had for brain injury, and then they kicked me out because they said, they interviewed me for 3 hours before they let me in. Then they let me in, and I went, and all they were teaching people was how to be mindful of where they were right now. And by then, I knew how to be mindful of where I was right now. Like, that's about all I knew how to do, right? And I wasn't trying to get back to where I was, and that was key. You get that? I wasn't trying to get back to who I'd been. It was so simple. I was just where I was. And, you know, I was fortunate enough that people cared for me and I was, you know, in good enough shape. But, so, and the doctors said, after they kicked me out of the group, they said, you don't need this group. They said, the most important thing is sleep. Mm-hmm. Which, and I wasn't a big sleep guy. I like to do stuff and, you know, bebop around here and there, but no. So I learned how to sleep a lot, meaning 8 hours a night, and sleep was one of the best things for my recovery. And then there were other weird things that I've done, including I can't remember what it's called. They put little electrodes on your head, and they stimulate different parts of the brain. This was not a doctor. This was a woman outside the box, totally, and that seemed. And she would do, you know, just a little bit each time, like less electricity than a cell phone, even. But and that helped, right? As part of the recovery, and you know, and I've gone to all kinds of weird healers, and one of them had a big impact, and quite a while, many years after the accident, still had a big impact. Like some fog went away from this guy just putting his hands on my head for an hour. You know, and who knows, but I don't know, but I'm happy he knows whatever the hell he knows. Okay. Please.
I had a completely different question,
please,
and I think it's a really big question. You could probably spend a week-long workshop talking about it.
Okay.
But I completely agree that we're all in everything together.
Yeah.
I don't have to agree, it's the reality.
Right.
And yet a lot of people are acting as if they're in it for themselves.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering whether you had any thoughts on how to skillfully respond to this dilemma.
Well, I do think one of the skillful things to do is to get here in a real way. I think meditation has, I think your presence has an impact on other people. Just like when somebody's a jerk, it has an impact on us, right? But if you're not a jerk, it also has an impact on people. And so just individually as one piece, that's really important. And then to see where are you drawn? What touches your heart? What do you care about in terms of the dilemma we're dealing with that you're pointing at, with so many people being out for themselves? And how might you be able to help in some way, meaning not individually, but collectively? How might we make help? Because we need to work collectively, whether it's about economics or politics or sexuality or race or religion or whatever it is. It's, we all need to work together. We're all here together. And that Sangha component is one of the undervalued parts of Buddhism, right? Like, everybody loves Buddha, right? And everybody loves the Dharma. And, you know, Sangha is like fine for 10 minutes, you know, or something. Or it's not as highly valued. And that's the piece that is suffering all of us together. Okay.
Thank you.
Sure.
I want to comment on that because I think, from my observations, two things. One, I think there's a risk when we say that we're all in this together. I think there's a risk of erasing some people's individual experiences. Because not everybody experiences a unity all the time. Let me finish.
Sure.
And there's a history of doing that, socially and politically and culturally.
Mm-hmm.
And so, when we make those broad sweeps without contextualizing,
right?
Those people in a space or a room can suddenly feel like, "Now, wait a minute, that's not my experience."
Right.
And in the same way of Sangha too, we see in different communities, Sangha is not always a safe space for everybody,
mm-hmm.
because of misuse of power, mm-hmm. or the culture of a Sangha makes other people not feel welcome.
Mm-hmm.
So we talk about knowing ourselves and centering, but I think a really important piece of that is understanding some of the worldly side, this direction,
uh-huh.
that is a part of that. So I just, anytime these kind of broad universal language gets used, I get nervous a little bit about how it can erase some of the things that are happening.
Right.
You know, because you say, everybody's out for themselves are really broad terms. I'm not really sure who you're speaking of when you say that, you know?
Right, but and so it's great you said something, because then Sangha includes you in saying something, because it's not just about what I say, right? And that that addresses part of what you're pointing at. And of course, then if we're here together, then I can say I wasn't trying to say that. Right, I wasn't saying, we're all here together, so everything's fine, because that's not my experience, right? And yet we all are here together. And so one of the things I like to talk about in Buddhism is the paradox of the Dharma. And here, I'll give you an example that I think is related to what you're pointing at. So after the election, I gave a lot of talk about politics at San Francisco Insight, because you know, it was up, right? And then after, 5-6 talks, I gave a talk about loving kindness, metta practice, right? And what does it mean to send metta to Donald Trump, right? Now that brought a lot of reactions from people, right? Because are you fucking kidding? I hate that guy. But in fact, that guy is suffering, right? Meaning Donald Trump is suffering, right? So that's hard to see when you don't like somebody, right? So all I'm saying is that, this all has to be included in the Dharma. Because the Dharma, at least in my opinion, is about being real, right? And so I appreciate the questioning any assumptions.
Eugene.
Okay.
You mentioned the difference perceived between us and the animal world. And I wonder, something I've been reflecting on is the sort of book about it, the universality of the Garden of Eden story.
Of the what
story? The Garden of Eden story, uh-huh. which is in many religions, uh-huh. is, and especially from a mindfulness perspective, is our self-consciousness a kind of fall from grace? Mm-hmm.
Is there a question about that, or I'm not sure?
I just wonder if you had any reflections on that.
Well, it's an interesting way to think of it.
That's kind of the fundamental problem of being human.
Right, yeah. No, it's a nice way to think about it, and I could Buddhize it a little bit. You know, the fall from grace is taking ourselves to be something we're not, which is what I believe you're pointing at in the fall from grace. And the fact that we're all here together with all the animals, right, in that way. And we're not the special animal. We're one of the animals. And this is good, because this is the same problem you're talking about a little, because we are special and we're not special. This is the paradox. And each animal is special in its own way, right? Like, if you're an elephant, you're an elephant. It's unique. But it's also just an animal like all the other animals, right? And this is the paradox, and it's the same for us. Whether we're black or brown or white or gay or straight or man or woman or trans or whatever our category might be, we're all different and unique, and that's to be totally respected. And we're all the same, which is part of the paradox. And it's, if I go a level deeper, it's the paradox of what's called duality and non-duality, right? And what I love in Buddhism, especially in Zen, when they talk about the two truths of relative truth and ultimate truth, they're equally true. That's great. Yeah, I believe that's great Dharma, because I tended to idealize ultimate truth and not get, oh, I'm putting relative truth down. That was my delusion. Okay? Please, Michelle. Okay. I was trying to make sure we have enough time. We have a couple more minutes. Please.
Thanks for your talk. I love the way you started it out. Also, like, that seems to me to be the issue I grapple with when I meditate. Like, who's or what is watching?
Yeah.
And, you know, the words came to me, I don't know where I heard them, somewhere in the retreats, but to rest in awareness.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And, like, what a novel idea. Uh-huh. You know, not that it isn't changing all the time, but that it's takes off, just such a, like, a relief.
Right.
In a way, that it's in that ongoing impermanence, in a way, it's somehow the same as it ever was.
Uh-huh.
You know? You have any thoughts about that?
About which? About resting in awareness?
Resting in awareness, yeah.
I like the phrase very much. I like what it points to. Mm-hmm. And I love when we start to become aware of awareness itself. Because everybody here is aware, am I correct? Are you all aware right now? Right? And there's this other good questions, like, where is the awareness? Right? You're all aware, and you're aware of me and what I'm saying, or what you're thinking, or what you're feeling, or the space, or the light, or right? But where is the awareness? Anybody know?
Good
looking is good. Mm-hmm. Because it, you know, well, you know, it's that helps point us at something that's not self. So often that's one of the dilemmas people have, is like when they hear about the teachings of not self in Buddhism, they're like, what are they talking about? You know, and so, yeah, the awareness, where's the awareness? Are you in control of it? Here, and here's one thing, and I like to experiment, so please experiment. Somebody stop being aware right now. Stop it. Can anybody stop being aware? Where's the awareness if you can't stop being aware? Please.
So going back to this gentleman's question about your TBI years ago after the bike accident, it just strikes me that you have a profound and unique experience around some of what we're talking about right now.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. But that experience is also available simply in meditation practice. And I've had experiences of that in meditation, but even before the accident, right? But that was a whole nother level of dukkha and the end of dukkha, because they're together, right? They come and go together. They're not, it's one of, again, one of the paradoxes is, at least for me, you know, I came to Buddhism, I heard about dukkha, it's like, and the end of dukkha, okay, let's get to the end of dukkha. You know, that's normal, but you only get to the end by being real about dukkha. You can't get there without that. Please, last one.
Okay, I was just interested in the beginning when you said you have to be comfortable with not knowing. Uh-huh. And this whole question about what is being aware, yeah. I really don't know what that is. And I kind of thought I was a bad Buddhist because I couldn't figure it out. Mm-hmm. But now I just think that's just fine. You know, in the 12 step, that might be what higher power is. You know, and everyone has a different definition of higher power. Every time I listen in group, I think, that's right.
Right.
And so whatever it is that is watching, I really don't know what it is, but I know that there's something there, and it's not me. So
right.
It's nice to know.
Okay. So it's we could play with it, too. If it's not you, where are you?
Where am I?
Yeah.
I don't understand the question.
No, that's good. I mean it, because even the idea of it's not me, well, it's not you, and maybe it is you also. This is a paradox again, right? Because where else is the awareness? And of course it may be everywhere, but let's stay with you as an individual for a moment. And so I said, well, where are you? And I'm not asking what are you, I'm saying where are you? Meaning even consciousness, where is that? Experience, good answer. He went like this. That's part of the not knowing. But staying with the not knowing, more gets revealed, but it may not be in that kind of linear intellectual way we're often used to. There might be other levels of intelligence that come through body, heart, and mind. Remember, those are all three centers in Buddhism, the body center, the hara, the heart center, the eye of wisdom. I mean, these are centers of reality that can wake up. So I think that's a good place to stop.
Maybe good spot
today.
Any announcements? Hello.
Hello. My name is Michael. This coming Saturday, April 14th, we're having a day-long retreat right here. It's entitled Passion and Compassion. The teacher is Dale Borglum, who's worked a lot with Death and Dying. And so this is sort of the final countdown for registration. Lunch is provided. There's no registration fee, but we ask that you contribute Donna to the teacher. There are flyers out on the credenza. If you have any questions, feel free to ask.
Hi, Cass.
Hi, I'm the host today, so please stay and enjoy the fellowship of the Sangha. There's some hot water for tea and some illusions of sweets. I'll be coming around with the Donna Bowl. Recommended or suggested donation is $10, but whatever you are moved to contribute will help the Sangha meet its commitments. Some people gather at the front door to go to lunch around 12:30, and anybody is welcome to join them.
Thank you.
Several months ago, we had a discussion here at the Sangha about social engagement.
Yes.
And there's going to be a follow-up discussion on May 7th following the regular meeting. So if you're interested in that dialogue, please attend.
I think it's the 6th.
At May 6th.
That's a Sunday, but...
Well, approximately that Sunday.
Okay, well, let's gather for closing. By the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness which is without sorrow. And may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, believing in the equality of all that lives.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.